If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to On the Continent, your one-stop shop for all things European football. I'm Dotton Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
On today's show, we look back at something of a strange summer, I think it's fair to say, for Lionel Messi and Barcelona, obviously, and maybe even for Man City. We'll come on to that in a moment or two. And we'll be wondering who on earth will play for PSG, whether they've played for a certain North London club or not. And also coronavirus problems, not just for PSG, I suppose right across the continent in football. And Ricardo Quaresma, well, that's got to be the story of this podcast for me in any case. Andy, Lionel Messi, Barcelona, what on earth is going on?
It's been coming for a long time. I think that's pretty clear. I think the interesting thing about the whole Messi and Barcelona situation is that I know some Barcelona fans and some regularly match-going Barcelona fans who were almost not happy, of course, with their 8-2 defeat to Bayern Munich in the Champions League, but sort of at a point that now the rest of the world knows we're not mad. They know we've not been exaggerating the problems that have been brewing at this club for a long time. And the fact that those problems have been bubbling towards the surface has been clear in the way, as I've said elsewhere, that Messi has approached this season in a media sense. He, in off-the-pitch terms, wants a quiet life. He's not Cristiano Ronaldo, who he's so often and erroneously compared with. He's someone who just wants to play and just wants to play to the most successful level possible. So if you know that, you know that his increasing sorties in the media this season show a man at the end of his tether. When he has to come out and he feels he has to bat back against Abidal, or when he has to bat back against the board. So this isn't an overnight thing, him coming out and saying, I can't be part of this madhouse anymore, is something that has been coming for quite a while. And I think what is the most interesting thing going forward, really, is what's going to happen between January and the middle of March. Because clearly this fracture has been exacerbated beyond repair in the relationship between him and the people who run the club under the last couple of years of Josep Bartomeu, the president, who he has clearly absolutely no respect for. Now, Bartomeu will go when there are club elections in March. The big questions are, can he go any sooner? Can the socios, the card-carrying fans, make him go any quicker? And what can be done about that window between January the 1st, when, because his contract's up in summer 2021, he can sign for someone else, he can sign for anyone else at that point for the following season. So what can be done from a Barcelona perspective to close the window between January the 1st and the point where Bartomeu leaves the club?
Mm. This is the thing. I mean, throughout all this, there's been some debate about how much is posturing from Messi, how much is this kind of leverage. But I think that was all exploded with his interview last Friday with Goal, which, I mean, it was actually extraordinary, especially when you put it in the context that Andy just did about the sort of figure Messi did, and someone who, for most of his career, hasn't actually said much in the media at all. And to then go with that, and not just what he said, but also to be saying it in the context of an interview where you're actually announcing that you're staying at the club, and then you just go and actually destroy everything about the club. And even that, there was a lot that stood out about it. But one, in terms of the problems for Barcelona as a team, was basically, he said, there's been no project here for years. In a sense, there's been no... And this has been one of the issues of Barca, and one of the issues that he's basically just about managed to pin together and win them title after title through his genius, that it's always just making do. And I mean, I was thinking about this when the story first broke, which I suppose was really after the Osasuna game, when he defeated Osasuna towards the end of last season, when he first kind of complained publicly and so prominently. But I mean, one of the first 11s you could put together from some of the Barca signings in the past few years, the last half decade alone, would be one of the strangest teams I think you'll ever see. I mean, Braithwaite, Vermaelen, Kevin Prince-Boateng, Paulinho. Which is not anything against any of those individual players, but they just seem so odd in the sense of what Barcelona should be. It's just a case of constantly plugging gaps, and those problems haven't gone away. And you would, I mean, in a broader sense, I actually think there are some potential positives for the Spanish league, if you want to draw it out. First of all, they keep possibly the best player of all time. I would think so. Because I was thinking about it, if Messi went to Manchester City, who does La Liga put in their promotional material?
I mean, speaking of that, what did you make of La Liga actually getting involved to clarify the contract? I mean, it does hark back to Neymar, doesn't it? And Javier Tebas involvement.
I mean, I think people close to Messi basically made that very clear as well, that, you know, all these intimations and kind of, you know, sources maintain La Liga isn't exactly an independent party in all this. La Liga is at a kind of a strange period in its recent history in that regard. But because of this, I mean, you can't even call it a transition with Barca, maybe more of a transition at Real Madrid, we could have a more open Liga this season where the points threshold from Barca and Madrid drops off. I mean, because the last few seasons, obviously, they've been getting averages of about, 90 points a year. That's been kind of taken as a given. That could potentially come down, because it's hard really to see Barca getting better.
That's right. And I think that's a good point, actually. Atletico, even if we're stretching it, Sevilla, cannot realistically challenge for the title in a 95-point season.
Yeah.
That simply can't happen. So I suppose it's the eternal quandary, really, isn't it? The eternal dilemma when it comes to leagues, and especially European leagues, where we've got into the habit of the same team winning it every year. And especially with La Liga, which we define really as a two-team league. or a lot of people define it as a two-team league. But the reality is, before last season, Barcelona won it 8 times out of 11.
Yeah, yeah.
That feels pretty one-team leaguey to me.
Yeah, and that was Messi's great legacy, I think, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we can quibble about his Champions League record, certainly in recent seasons, but I think he was a victim of circumstances at Barca. And there was a sense they basically wasted the potential of the best player of all time. But I think, I mean, if you look at what Messi is as a player, and it's just kind of this extraordinary everyday exceptionalism, everyday exceptional ability, everyday brilliance. And there's no greater format than a league to actually translate that, because it's just kind of it's just result after result after result. You know, his highlights reel from a few weeks could be the highlight reels of kind of other great players' careers. And that's I think where you see, and let's not forget that, you know, for most of Barcelona's history, the league title hasn't been their preserve. It's been Real Madrid's. Real Madrid have usually been the default winners. Messi has made them the default winners in Spain.
I just wonder, you know, we've talked a lot, Dotton, about how there are no real winners out of this, because Barcelona are left with, you know, albeit the greatest player in the world, a player who doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
He's left in a situation that he doesn't want to be in. I wonder if, going a little bit further down the line, there are any real winners for this as well. I mean, you could say Barcelona, in terms of saving his absolutely heinous wages going forward.
Well, that's one thing I was going to say. And I almost feel, it feels a bit sacrilegious to kind of to say it, but I have been thinking a lot throughout all this. I mean, Messi is, like, whatever I think about him as the greatest player, he's one of my favourite players ever. I literally count the amount of times I've watched him live, 31 now. But yeah, at the same time, given he is 33, and given even if he has 4 years left, 5 years left, as a absolutely brilliant player, we are getting to the point now where any club that would sign him, had he even left, has to think about a post-Messi life. And
can you, though? I don't think you can, because I think this is where you can make a Messi and Ronaldo comparison. Because the fact is, I think you look at Juventus, and if I'm an elite club, that puts me, looking at Juventus over the past couple of years, puts me off buying Messi.
Yeah, yeah.
Not because they're the same player,
yeah,
but because they've completely changed their timeline of how they've done things for one person. And Ronaldo's done nothing wrong on the pitch.
Yeah.
He's done everything they could have asked for him and more. He scored a shit ton of goals. He scored goals in all the big games, but they're further away than they were from winning the Champions League. And why? A huge part of that is because they said originally to Paulo Dybala, you sign the contract, we want you to be our Messi.
Yeah.
We want you to be our player to drag us forward. And he said, oh, that's great. And then all of a sudden they're like, Ronaldo's available? Yeah, we didn't really say that. forget that. And then, of course, the fact is they need to regenerate, reinforce that squad,
yeah,
make that squad as good as it gets. How can you do it when you've got so much money tied up in Ronaldo? Well, you can't do it.
That's exactly the thing. I think this is relevant to European, many of the major European leagues as a whole. Messi, I mean, Barca are basically in massive need of a refresh. Even Messi himself is arguing that. But that refresh, that rebuild, is basically impossible while you have Messi's wages on the books, because it has too much of a gravitational force. And it's same, I think any club that signed him, unless it was Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, would basically have had to sacrifice their medium-term planning, because he just cost that much. And that is the one downside. And it was the one thing, the one potential positive, had, for all the fallout, had Barca got rid of him, it meant suddenly so much money was released to basically rebuild the side. And there is a wider point here, because the trend of European football now is going, and I think this is one reason why Messi hasn't won the Champions League for a few years. The trend of European football is basically going towards, obviously what's dominant now is this kind of German pressing. That is now the dominant form of football, the most influential. And that requires younger squads, very energetic squads.
And a squad.
Yeah, and a squad.
Not just an 11.
Yeah, yeah. That Barca have been unable to put together.
Look, this is fascinating for me. I've got a huge grin on my face, because it's always a point where you consider when things fall apart for a football club. And what you're both saying is that even when things fall apart, there is still a comparison between Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. Taking that point, though, conversely, from your thoughts, Andy, a moment or two ago about how Juventus's timeline was derailed by signing Cristiano Ronaldo. What about Barcelona then? If Messi stays there, they've got a new broom in Ronald Koeman as a coach. He has kept his own counsel over this, as far as I can tell. What happens then?
The one thing that, just to cut across a second, the flip side of that is, had Messi left, there has been a lot of murmurs out of Barcelona that so much of their sponsorship deals and so many contracts might be tied in to the ongoing presence of Messi. And that if he left, then the fallout for the hierarchy of the club could have been even worse, because then they've got an awful mess to clear up. And maybe not as much money for rebuild as I would have thought, because they just don't have the same income streams. And suddenly there's a lot to take care of.
But even if there is that money... Yeah. Do you trust the governorship to spend it correctly? I don't think you do. I think the question is no longer whether Bartomeu is going. Everyone knows where Bartomeu is going. The question is, how much damage can he do in his remaining time at the club?
Yeah.
And I think there's possibly a significant amount still.
Like I say, things fall apart. And Ronald Koeman is in the middle of this, watching things fall apart. What does he do?
At least he can say, I've been here at the eye of a financial storm in La Liga with Valencia before.
But do we think Koeman was a good signing?
I think he's the best from a limited market, because what huge, like, elite level coach wants that job at the moment under the current conditions?
Because
for him, I think it's difficult for him to reject Barcelona. One, because it's the job he's always wanted. And two, I think we have to look at his personal situation.
Yeah.
I think the fact that Euro 2020, which he would have loved to coach the Netherlands through, has been pushed a little bit further away. He knows the opportunity won't be there for him next year.
Yeah.
And also, he's 57 years old. I think that's because he still looks quite young.
Yeah,
it's quite easy to forget. And he had heart surgery this summer. I think that makes you maybe recalibrate the way that you look at things, and maybe that's.
But he's got this headache, though. That won't be good for his heart. And I don't mean to be disparaging about his illness at all, but he's got this headache, which is Lionel Messi. What does he do with Lionel Messi? I don't get where he's going to move. How he's going to move it?
By Memphis Depay. I think that's the obvious one. I think you have to control the controllables, really, if you're Ronald Koeman. And you've got to accept that Messi is so big and has become bigger than the club, that you've got to almost, I think, divorce yourself from that. He can't deal with that, and he knows he can't deal with that. If he gets to use him, then great. I think that will be a definite plus for him. But I think what he's doing, getting in a sort of spinal column that he trusts, and of course, like the view is to getting Gigi Wijnaldum as well, players who've done well for him in a recent context, who will interpret what he wants on the pitch. I think there's actually quite a lot of sense. And there's quite a lot of low-cost sense in that as well, which is something that is good for Barcelona, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the point you made about the spine is a good one in that sense. Well, I think because in relation to the Champions League, given it's a cup and, you know, it is much more open to the quirks of fortune than a league campaign.
And people overlook that, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's often, it's always, you know, you have to be the absolute top standard to win the Champions League. You don't. And that's been proven by some recent winners, including Real Madrid in some of their seasons.
Yeah.
And they haven't necessarily had the most sophisticated team structure. Sometimes it's felt like it's basically just Cruz and Modric imposing a playing style on the team. But with that in mind, I mean, it's something I've always... It's often felt as if, with some Barcelonas, they try to play a game, and especially under Quique Setién, I suppose, given he was basically an ideological choice for a team that's not built to an ideological model anymore, that they try to impose a game that the squad isn't suited to, that kind of just makes them this kind of weird... It actually detracts from what they do best.
They're like slaves to branding,
Exactly. When a little bit like when Argentina were at their best with Messi, like say 2014, where the team is basically just about put together so it can function, be solid, but also just ensure Messi is in sufficient positions to do damage. And that can go a long way in Europe.
Beide kanten veel gebeurde. Nedved is boos op Mejuto González. Maar...
I'm
Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
I'm glad that we've had one Donald Rumsfeld quote or misquote today, which is the controllable controllables. So there are controllable controllables, and of course there'll be uncontrollable uncontrollables, and we could carry on forever. But we must go to Ibiza. Clearly, all the footballers go to Ibiza. But at a time like this, when they're supposed to be staying within their bubbles, these are professionals. What? PSG, do they not know that? Going to Ibiza, do they not know that there's a virus out there?
I think the way that the club is presenting a public response to this and the way they're dealing with it behind closed doors are two separate things. To reiterate, for those who are unfamiliar...
Tell us about Gareth Southgate.
And you've just been in Denmark, so you should know.
It's the dream job. It's the dream job. But I think when you look at what Paris Saint-Germain were meant to do schedule-wise, they were meant to start their Ligue 1 campaign a week after the Champions League final. Now, they went to the league and said, we want a bit of extra time off. Now, that on the surface of it feels reasonable, even in these unreasonable times. The way I would look at it, two ways. Firstly, their first game of the season was due to be against Lens away. Now, Lens are one of the traditionally most passionately supported clubs in France. You can't say France generally is a football hotbed, really, in terms of passion, certainly in terms of quality in on the pitch. I don't think you can argue with it. But, you know, it's not always been followed with that same fervour as other countries. And Lens, Marseille, Saint-Étienne are exceptions to that. So Lens, they're playing their first home match, their first proper home match in Ligue 1 in 9 years. Because the last time they were up, 5 years ago, they were having their ground done up, the Bollard. They were having it done up for Euro 2016. So they were playing at Amiens, just up the road. Anyway, they are looking forward to this immensely. Their first proper home game in 9 years in the top flight against Paris Saint-Germain. They're like... Oh, well, it's a bit difficult to get over emotionally. We need a bit of a rest. Even with our budget that's three times the size of anyone else, even with our absolutely enormous squad, we just need a bit of time off with our families.
In Ibiza.
Never mind the fact... Well, we haven't even got to that yet, but never mind the fact that Lyon have had, what, 3 days more rest? Because they went out in the semi. Mm. And they played on the Friday. So they played... 9 days. They started their league campaign 9 days after their Champions League campaign ended, with far less resources. Anyway, so Lance, their whole attitude is like, oh, come on, man. You know, you're denying our supporters this chance anyway. But they're like, look, we'll be rested. The stars will be there in their best fettle. So anyway, a load of them go off to Ibiza, come back with coronavirus. Mm. Now, Leonardo, the sporting director of Paris Saint-Germain.
Brazilian, of course.
Yes, yeah. He has, in his second spell at the club as a sporting director, has come out and said, I love this quote, I hate Instagram. And he said, well, don't we all when we get caught doing stuff we shouldn't have done? But the thing is, he said, well, Instagram's made it seem that it's something it's not, because they were there with their families and all the rest of it. Yet we saw that on Instagram. The fact is that there's no miswriting or misquoting or misattributing intentions about the fact that Neymar, Di Maria, Paredes, Marquinhos, Keylor Navas, Mauro Icardi all come back with coronavirus. Of course, since then, Kylian Mbappe has been diagnosed with coronavirus as well. So a slight change to the rules in how these outbreaks are dealt with in France means that they will be able to start their league campaign with that game at Lens tonight on Thursday, with obviously quite a reduced squad. Because before, if you had four players that tested positive, that would be regarded as an outbreak and they would call the game off. But they thought, well, you know what, cases are rife enough that, and testing cases are used often enough that we should be able to contain it. If you've got 20 players out of your 30-man squad who are uninfected, then you can play, because otherwise we're going to get matches postponed left, right and centre. So they're going to go to that. And obviously Lens do get their home game in front of 5,000 fans on a Thursday night. And as one of the Lens players was saying, like, we were kind of hoping to play the stars. You know, people are saying, this is a good thing for Lens. But their coach, Franquez, said, well, do you want me to say we're the favourites? Yeah. We're still playing Paris Saint-Germain. They've still got Verratti and Draxler. So it's kind of...
It's the B team, isn't it? Essentially,
basically,
is what they're saying.
It's like if you're Wimbledon and you were, say, to draw Watford in the cup, who, you know, we would have got if we'd have beaten Oxford on penalties. I'm not dwelling on that.
Okay.
But the fact is, it's the worst possible draw for a cup game, because there's none of the glamour, but ultimately you're going to get beaten. And Lens are kind of in that situation as well.
Yeah, totally. Funny though, it's the whole football on holiday coronavirus thing is a very interesting one. So, whatever about Instagram, someone at a top European club was telling me you should look very carefully at training photos. Who's there, who isn't, how many youth players are drafted in, because he reckons this has been much more of an issue than has actually come out, and that's across Europe.
In what sense?
In the sense that a lot of players have... basically, the players' holidays have been more... quite. I'm not sure if concern is the right word, but they've all gone away. They've all...
The players haven't been professional, have they?
I'm trying to think of how legally the phrase is.
Well, they haven't stayed within their bubbles. We know that. The French players go to Ibiza, the English players go to Iceland, and it's a similar thing, I'd have thought.
Well, I suppose, I mean the difference with England is, of course, they were actually in a bubble of
at work.
Yeah. and benefiting from an athlete's exemption, whereas when you go on holiday, you don't.
I'd still rather go to Ibiza.
Yeah.
In Iceland. If you're going to get coronavirus, I'm not making light of coronavirus, I know it's a very serious problem, but you're talking about young people here, young players. Essentially, with most of these players, they're in their 20s. It's not about the hormones raging necessarily, but people, you know, if they get the opportunity, they want to go out and rave. We've seen that here in the UK.
And
it's
I think as
for them.
As a top-level footballer, you feel invincible as well.
Well,
That's part of it, isn't it, surely?
I'm slightly surprised. I mean, this maybe comes into what you're saying about the invincibility. I'm slightly surprised more clubs didn't place more restrictions on where their players were able to go on holidays. But then I suppose
You know what? I wonder if you can do that with big stars at Paris Saint-Germain, because they've always got this balance. They must have a lot of players there, and, you know, naming no names, who are a bit, you're lucky to have me.
Yeah.
You know? I think there's maybe part of that. I'm starting to think of the names.
Yeah, I've got a couple.
I think when you pay that level of wages, you're conveying a certain level of privilege without even saying it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know?
Actually, just, I mean, this is a slight, not a tangent, but almost going back a little bit. Because it's something I've been thinking about since the Champions League final and the nature of their defeat. For all the talk of PSG moving on to a next level and that they'd broken this, that had his mental breakthrough, to some degree, this supposedly breakthrough season ended in the same way it always does, with this team going out to the first other super club they faced.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. On the other hand, I do think they're, much as people thought they were lucky with their draw up to the final, they're exceptionally unlucky to play a team that, I know they could have beaten them if they'd have scored one of those chances in the first half, but realistically, a team that was always going to be exceptionally difficult to beat. I mean, we talked about how footballers have been coping with lockdown and various restrictions. Bayern used it to muscle up.
Yeah,
but you see the size of those guys after the final. Like, even Coutinho looked stacked.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have looked very different to the other 5'8" players that turned up for the first day of training at Barcelona.
Did it make a difference? Was it that made the difference?
Yeah, I think it did, Dutton, because I think if you look at the final, the way they ground down Paris Saint-Germain in the second half of that, I mean, I think they're simply a better team as well. I don't want to detract from their technical quality and the technical quality of those players. But I think what showed actually, to me, how far Paris Saint-Germain had come, I think 999 out of 1,000 teams lose that final, even after playing a good first half, 3 or 4 nil, because they absolutely ran over them. They steamrolled them like they did a lot of clubs this season, like they did a lot of good teams this season. And for the most part, they stood up to that.
Yeah. I mean, also about that game, actually, it did feel as if, I know this is a bit of an intangible, but as if kind of Bayern's greater European legacy almost kind of manifested itself a bit in that it was one of those, it felt like one of those classic almost, once Bayern got the goal, it felt like, I say, one of those ties like Juventus against Manchester United in the late 90s, where once the more experienced team was ahead, that was that. Mm. And even though Paris Saint-Germain had chances late on, they were kind of snatching at it. And it was, Bayern always felt under control. It did feel as if they had that kind of greater level of nous almost, or...
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Say if we just distill it to Neymar, actually. Mm. I think the interesting thing about him, and we talk about how different, or Leonardo talks about how different Instagram is from real life. Mm. I think because of his public persona, it's easy to forget what an incredibly hard worker he is.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, just because he craves responsibility doesn't mean he can always deal with the pressure,
because
I felt he struggled with that a little bit against Atalanta in the quarterfinal as well. And until Mbappe came on, he was on the brink of like losing his shit and kicking someone and getting sent off.
Classic Neymar, yeah.
Yeah.
Does Leonardo still have the looks?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. He's still got the looks, because he's arguably the most eloquent former footballer there is. He speaks so poetically, but the ladies love him. So if he hadn't gone on to be this big cheese at PSG, he would have been the star of any football TV show. If you want to attract women, go for Leonardo. But having said that, PSG do have ambition, don't they, Miguel? They do have ambition going forward. That loss in the Champions League final must have hurt them to a certain extent. But I understand from a piece that you've just written in The Independent that their ambition is stretching all the way to North London.
Yeah. Well, that's what they are, ahead of anyone else in the race, to use tabloidies, for Hector Bellerin. There have been meetings between PSG and his representatives. He's got a lot of it. I mean, Arsenal, I think, are taking the reluctant decision to sell him. There are maybe some arguments that they feel he might have hit a ceiling as a player. And if there's one area where they can kind of sacrifice someone to basically raise sales for more necessary positions, it's right back, given they might have Maitland-Niles. But yeah, I think Arsenal are going to reluctantly sell Bellerin and want 30, 35 million for him. And Paris Saint-Germain look, at the moment, the likeliest to pay it.
Having said that, Barcelona, his former home club, obviously his childhood club, is also in the running, as I understand it, to sign Hector Bellerin for a lot less money. I don't think they've got the money.
Yeah. And if it came down to that, at Barca, I don't think we'll be able to compete, which is great, again, sums up kind of the problem we've been talking about earlier.
To me, 30 million seems like quite a lot. I don't know about you, Miguel. I mean, you've seen Bellerin at even closer quarters than I have over the last couple of years, covering so much Premier League football. So I personally feel with Bellerin, and maybe going back to what we were talking about with Neymar, it's the package. I mean, the whole persona is very attractive. He's very like my wife's favourite footballer, for example. Because, and I think that's important. I'm not
before
saying,
he cut his hair like Messi.
Actually, just now that you mention that, here's an interesting one. So Bellerin is basically seen as possibly the most socially conscious footballer.
Exactly. Is, yeah. Right. There's the Forest Green Rovers.
Yeah, all of that. He's very into environmental consciousness. He's probably very left wing. And yet, he is willing to be, if he joins Paris Saint-Germain, he's willing to be what would be essentially a proxy ambassador for Qatar.
That's interesting, isn't it?
So how does that fit?
It's a very, very interesting question.
That's a lot to put on a young shoulder.
Well, I mean,
he's 25 years old.
But if you make yourself such a spokesman, you have a responsibility to think about these decisions. Like we all know what these clubs are at this point.
But Marcus Rashford, for example, makes himself such a spokesman on an issue. Doesn't mean that we have to hang the entire fortunes of this government on him.
But Rashford. I mean, Rashford isn't, even by playing for Manchester United, he's not, by doing that, he's not an ambassador for the sort of politics or the sort of capitalism.
He is now,
he's not an ambassador for the sort of politics or the sort of capitalism that the Glazers would perpetuate, because the model of ownership isn't the same. Whereas with Paris Saint-Germain or with Manchester City, the political objective of the owners is very naked. And we've got to the point with both of those clubs where you can't go to them blindly and think, say with Pep Guardiola 2 years ago when he came under criticism for the yellow ribbon stuff. You can't just pretend that you don't know about this. So if you're someone that is so socially conscious and so well spoken on so many issues, you can't plead ignorance on this other side.
Isn't it one of those issues, with all due respect, isn't it one of those issues that wherever you go to as a top flight footballer, apart from Wimbledon AFC, of course, and Charlton, by the way, let me take the Charlton bit back. Wherever you go to as a top flight footballer, you will be having to dance with the devil to some extent.
Okay, yeah, but there is a spectrum. And obviously, the sheer size of European football now, and it's kind of the amount of power, almost kind of social power, allows, political capital it allows, means it basically attracts, questionable interests from all areas of society. But even within that, Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City are two very, very different clubs. They're two unique clubs because they are the only clubs essentially owned and run by states for political purposes, where both clubs are almost political vehicles for the state.
So picking that up, I was actually going to say originally, I think there's a strong argument that if they get 25, 30 million for Bellerin, Arsenal, I think that's very good value. Because personally, I don't know what you feel, but I feel he's been nowhere near the player he once promised to be.
But he got the injury.
He did, but the fact remains that he is not the player that everyone thought he would be.
The first couple of seasons, would you not say that? The first couple of seasons when he was bombing down the right wing for Arsenal.
Oh, he looked like crossing. That was when he was originally being linked with Barcelona.
Yeah.
When Barcelona were, I'm not saying they're a club not to aspire to be part of anymore, but when they were, the best, and he was, thought as of almost preordained to go back there at some point. Whereas now, going back to Miguel's point, I wonder if that's what they are buying. They're not buying just a good right back, but someone who maybe softens the image a little bit.
Adds a bit of kudos, It ties into the whole kind of glamour and kind of they want to perpetuate what Paris are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm going to have to ask my little nephew, because despite the fact that you've seen Bellerin at very close quarters, he's seen him at even closer quarters because he played against him.
All right.
And he said that Bellerin, this is when I started taking him seriously, Hector Bellerin, that he was the first player to have him in his pocket the whole game. Mm. And Bellerin can do that to opposition. Mm. He can have them in their pocket. They're not going to get the ball off him at any point. He's going to skip past them and cross that ball when it comes down to the corner flag. Cross that ball for a goal. And he scores one or two goals himself, and it's always a celebration. Okay, I think it's time for us to go yee-haw!
Allez, le 2 a fonctionné. Quaresma à l'extérieur du pied.
Oh, oui!
L'extérieur du pied de Ricardo Quaresma. Voilà, il fallait un coup de génie pour débloquer un match qui était très, très bloqué.
So, Andy, do you want to tell us what that yee-haw was about?
Well, you have to go to the end of Ricardo Quaresma's signing video to get to that. I think it's the start of something pretty special for Portuguese football. No, not the fact that they're signing a 37-year-old player, even if he's one who's like still got a lot of quality.
Still looks good. We saw his pecs in the video.
Yeah, absolutely. We certainly did. And I think that Ricardo Quaresma has gone to Guimarães, for me, is very exciting because he's one of my favourite players, and they're an extraordinarily historical club. But I think it's very interesting how Portuguese clubs, who obviously don't have a lot of disposable cash, especially compared with a lot of the European elites we're talking about here, they've gone with some very, very innovative, very thoughtful social media approaches to get their message out there. We had this with we talked about it on the main ramble about Passos de Ferreira announcing their fixtures the other week with their beaver mascot, basically announcing who they were playing in the various fixtures by doing something associated with that team. So for example, when they were playing Porto, the beaver was sitting in a chair in a restaurant, and he receives a francesinha, which is the traditional, very cheesy sandwich that you get in Porto. And he sat there, and he sprinkled a bit of hay over it and tucked in. Then you had him like grilling a chicken when they were playing Gil Vicente, because the cock of Barcelos comes from there, etc., etc. He's lost in the fog when they're playing Marítimo because it's really foggy in that little part of Madeira. It was decent. Anyway, with Quaresma, you think of this guy, and that, you know, they have him in this church, and he's there in like a sort of smoking jacket, bare chest.
That's
underneath.
A castle, isn't it?
Yeah, castle. Sorry. Yeah. Sort of bare-chested underneath with all his bling. And he comes outside, he puts the shirt on, he comes outside, and he's offered the keys to the Mustang. And that
you've forgotten the butler. Come on, yeah, the butler plays a big part, but it's an important part.
Yeah, the butler offers him the keys to the Mustang, yeah, doesn't he, after giving him his shirt. And he's offered the keys to the Mustang. And Mustang was his first nickname when he was a young player coming through. And he says no to the Mustang, and he goes back in the castle.
He doesn't say no. He looks at the camera and like,
yeah, and he goes back in the castle and comes out on a white horse in his
Mustang,
shirt.
Obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, it's worth pointing out that the first Portuguese king is from Guimarães, which is why it says, long live the king, and he comes out as the new king. But Quaresma is just ceaselessly fascinating to me, because if you'd have looked at him when he was 25 and you'd have said that he's still playing at a good level when he's 37, I don't think anyone would have believed you. You go back a little bit further than that when he's 19 or 20 and you compare him coming through the Sporting Academy with Cristiano Ronaldo, who's 2 years older than. If you'd have asked most Sporting watchers then, they would have said Quaresma is going to be the star, mm-hmm, and Cristiano Ronaldo's going to have a good career. Because in terms of natural talent, Quaresma can do stuff with the ball that you absolutely cannot believe.
But at that point, he did look like the more complete player, didn't he, than Ronaldo? Ronaldo felt more kind of like as if he had so much more of his game to work on. A bit more raggedy, whereas Quaresma, at that early stage, looked so much more polished as a player.
And he was physically ahead of where Ronaldo is as well. Whereas you look at Quaresma now, he's solid, but he's not playing number nine in the near future. You know, Ronaldo is an absolute tank, and his physical evolution is absolutely incredible.
Didn't you remember that? I remember you giving me an anecdote about how Quaresma and Ronaldo used to come up with a new trick every day. Do you remember that?
Yeah, they used to do that.
Once upon a time.
That it really irritated the coach, Laszlo Bologna, who was at Sporting at the time. This was the last time that Sporting won the league. They were both there. This was in 2002, and they've not really come that close since, give or take one or two occasions. But the thing is with Quaresma is, you know, he had a couple of big club moves that failed. So I think one big club move where you fall on your face when you're young, you can get away with, and that was him at Barcelona. But then you have, after he was very successful at Porto, Inter didn't work out. Chelsea was a little bit different because Luis Felipe Scolari signed him and then got sacked less than a week later.
But it didn't work out nevertheless.
Yeah, absolutely. He didn't really get his chance. Now, the Scolari thing was a little bit different because him and Scolari had such an incredible closeness. And this, I think, is a theme with Quaresma, of something that's very important to him. Scolari felt so strongly about Quaresma that when he had that dispute, it was in a qualifier between, at the Dragao actually in Porto, between Portugal and Serbia, when Dragutinovic of Serbia, who used to play for Sevilla, shoved Quaresma out of the way, Scolari came across from the bench and he hit Dragutinovic in the face. And Dragutinovic is a big guy. He's like 6'4" and really heavily
so
built.
Scolari,
and well, no, he just punches his weight. I think that's the difference. But they interviewed him in the flash straight afterwards, and they said, "You hit Dragutinovic," and he went, "No, it didn't." It's like, well, you did, and everyone saw it on live television. And he went, "I'm just defending my boy. I'm just defending my boy." And it got made into sketches on Portuguese comedy programs and all the rest of it. But it does show the closeness between those two, and B, what Quaresma needs to thrive. I mean, a lot of the perceptions about him, they're rooted in ethnic prejudice, really, because people will say, oh, well, the reason he can, like people who you would consider reasonable people, they still bring out that prejudice against gypsies. They'll go, oh, well, he's a gypsy. You can't expect him to sound straight. Now, people still say that stuff. It's outrageous. The thing is with Quaresma, if you're comparing him to Cristiano Ronaldo, there's always going to be a drop off because Ronaldo is the most motivated footballer in the history of footballers. Yeah. Whether you think he's the best is a different question, but he's where he is because he has this obsessive desire to succeed.
Yeah.
Now, Quaresma wants to win, but you can't really judge him by that standard. And also, I think you've always sensed, like the one cliche that you can tick about him, he's always needed that sense of family around him. And he found that at Porto, and he found that at Besiktas. And if he can find that at Guimarães as well, he's still got loads of quality and they could do well out of it.
Just on that, actually, what was the relationship between Ronaldo and Quaresma then? Who's the senior figure?
It's interesting because that has changed.
Yeah.
And I think the interesting thing when you spend time with Portugal is how the relationship with Ronaldo and a lot of those players he grew up with has changed, because you would expect them to be like pally and matey with him. And there's no standoffishness exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But they kind of revere him in a weird way, even the people he's grown up with.
Yeah.
Since he's become this, he's grown into this god in Portugal. The relationship between Ronaldo and Quaresma, though, is quite particular, because you remember at the last World Cup where Quaresma scored his classic Travella outside of the boot shot against Iran. A brilliant goal. It's the only time in recent memory that I've seen Ronaldo, well, he was joyous at that moment, which was amazing. But to see him even interested in someone else scoring a goal was something that was quite remarkable. But the other thing for Quaresma going forward into this season, Guimarães have got a new coach, Thiago, who's the head coach of a top team for the first time. Thiago, who of course was midfielder for Benfica, Porto, Chelsea. He had that pretty good season at Chelsea. He played more matches than people think, and he scored that brilliant goal at Old Trafford when they'd already won the league, and Atletico Madrid. And he was a huge part of Atletico's success, or should I say Diego Simeone's success at Atletico. He was that kind of on-pitch coach for him. And he was one of those guys, you know, you think about Nuno at Wolves, for example, who was almost a coach before he was a coach because he spent so much time on the periphery of things. And Thiago, in the back end of his career, was injured a lot. So he was on bench doing quite a lot of the similar things that Gabby did on the pitch when he was the captain, that he's almost like a player coach without that officially being the case. So I tend to think that it will do quite well. I think one of the reasons that Quaresma has turned up there is because he's someone who people think, you know, who people respect and admire at the elite of the European game. And I think he could be a really good coach going forward. Guimaraes should be good to watch.
He nearly ended up in India. You know this?
Were we talking about Thiago or Quaresma?
No, Quaresma.
Right.
Do you know that?
Tell me.
Apparently there was an Indian team after him as well, but right, they decided to balk at his 1.5 million euro, whatever it is, fee.
But he's got all the jewels in the world anyway. Yeah, like, yeah. What could he possibly need?
But you can't drop your fee, can you? Just because...
Well, he's even got Castle to store some of them in there.
And he's got a Mustang as well. look, I think it's fair to say that there is one point in proceedings when you normally, Andy, say to us, air some freeness, come, give us the love. Yeah, we're going to get some free TV, football on TV, free.
Yeah, and people have made a bit of a thing of this. But the thing is, I was looking forward to doing it this week, Don, when we sort of normally come up with a game of the week on the continent. But obviously, I would have gone with the restart of La Liga. And they're doing this thing, or they were doing this thing, called Football Fridays, where they have every game on a Friday night would be shown free in the UK.
And
you think, fantastic, Granada versus Athletic. Granada
Hooray! Just
qualified for Europe for the first time. Roberto Soldado!
Hooray!
Thank you. Not happening because of the row between Miguel, the La Liga and the RFEF, the Spanish FA, that's been brewing for a while. I don't know, can you even describe it as a row between the two bodies? Because really, it's a row between two men, isn't it?
Yeah.
Javier Tebas and Luis Rubiales.
Yeah, essentially. And that is it. And a clash of, how to put this again diplomatically, forthright personalities who enjoy the influence they have. I was actually, just before we came on, I just did a Google search of La Liga or FEF controversy, and the amount of different stories, the amount of different things they've clashed over, like, it's just an endless, and I, like, you see some of the headlines and you think, Spanish FA calls for Liga President Tebas to resign. Like, oh, what's that related to? Then there's one, a similar story, a few links down, which is related to something else entirely, but another call for his resignation. And yeah, and that is essentially it. It's, I mean, there are obviously other elements tangled up in this, but one of those, I suppose, is a little bit like that England has had, in that it's one organisation who are concerned with the game in their country, which is the FEF or the FA, say, and then another competition, which is almost becoming something, an organisation into itself, and sees itself almost as an international brand, which is Liga. And
that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah,
the international part of it. Yeah.
And that has fostered most of the biggest issues over the last few years, including this weekend, because the FEF are basically, you know, criticizing La Liga for trying to smuggle in international, smuggle in fixtures on dates they don't want, that they think kind of overly influences the kind of traditions of Spanish football, the way they, again, the same sort of debates we've seen in England, and it ultimately comes down to, as well, the ambition of La Liga. And La Liga would say it's important to try, well, La Liga would argue, or Tebas would argue, that this is all for the benefit of Spanish football, because it's about bringing more money into Spanish football, increasing the profile of Spanish football, and you know, La Liga investigating whatever they can do to increase the profile and compete with the Premier League, like games in Miami. Mm. And the RFEF just see this as absolute sacrilege.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's been what I've learned from this one is what Miguel was saying earlier. This is the most profound thing. Study those training photographs of your teams very, very closely.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.